Good afternoon. Muy buenas tardes. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org, live on the Internet. This is the Monday Brownbagger, and I'm Alfred Weber. And we'd like to welcome a very special guest today, independent scientist Loren Murray, who has been an expert witness at the Tokyo International Tribunal for war crimes in Afghanistan, and we'd like to welcome her. She's appearing today from Berkeley, California. Welcome.
Thank you, Alfred. It's always nice to speak to a Canadian audience as well as the larger global audience. So very nice to be on your program again.
Thank you. Well, you know, today I'd like to tell the audience that we're starting a new series here on the Monday Brownbagger, and it's called The Economic Takedown of the USA. That is an intentional economic takedown, what we could call an economic false flag operation. And I'd like to sort of give a quote to kind of delineate the series. And that is that, quote, the subprime mortgage crisis was an economic false flag operation of the Bush administration kleptocracy. There was a deliberate deregulation leading to the subprime crisis, and in the latter days of the Bush administration, a pseudo bailout whose purpose was the transfer of wealth from the U.S. Treasury to the owners of the U.S. Federal Reserve System, who are, as one can see from an ownership chart, the Rothschild City of London interests, end of quote. So this economic takedown of the USA, we're looking at it really in terms of economic war crimes. And I wondered if you could begin to address the subprime mortgage crisis and everything that has occurred before and subsequently to that, that's connected to it in terms of an economic war crime by the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization.
Well, the U.S. mortgage crisis, this isn't the only one, and it's not the first one. This occurred in Japan 20 years ago, and it was very, very similar, carried out the same way, and of course the same people were behind it, the international financiers or City of London Rothschild interests. So it's just deja vu. And what happened is as inflation continued and property values increased, people were encouraged to borrow money and to buy property, keep it for a year or 2 years on speculation, and then sell it. Now, doing that, they were assuming that the prices would continue to rise. However, that dream collapsed, and people were actually losing their property by foreclosure even 6 months after they bought it, because property prices were falling. And it's affected everything. Pension funds were invested in real estate and the stock market. And this is all crashed by 40%. It's devalued by 40%. So this has terribly impacted pension funds. And it means that people cannot expect the retirement payouts that they were expecting. So it's going to force people to work longer and not be able to retire as soon as they wanted to. Many, many people have lost their property, their empty houses all over the United States, abandoned. Why in the world did the banks do this? Because now these empty houses are going to physically degrade, and then people are breaking into them and looting them and damaging them and so forth. So the bankers were just too greedy, And the big gambling casino, which is Wall Street and the housing market and the mortgage scam and everything, has come to a roaring halt. And even, this has even affected global shipping, because that is down 95%. It's just shut down global transportation or global shipping by sea. And the car dealerships have 9 months of inventory sitting at the docks. They have to pay for them to be parked in parking lots at the docks. They have nowhere to put them on their car lots. And so this has really affected everything, even the state of California workers, without hardly any announcement at all, are having 2 Friday no-work days a month now, which is decreasing their monthly salary by at least 9%. So as the economy comes to a screeching halt, people stop spending, they start saving and hoarding money, which is the opposite of what they should be doing to get the economy going again. And I think I'd like to read a quote by Richard C. Cook. It's from his article called Extraordinary Times, Intentional Collapse, and Takedown of the USA. It was published on September 5th, 2008. It's very, very recent. And as a U.S. federal government analyst who worked in many departments of the U.S. government, he really has a very good knowledge of how the government works. So this is what he said, quote, as the 20th century advanced, the financier elite became heavily involved in getting rich off World War and the manufacture of the new weapons of mass destruction that modern technology made possible. Warfare and weaponry, combined with control of credit manufactured through the leveraging of industrial production, were to be the primary means of putting nations and their populations into debt. A materialistic slave society was being created, which books like 1984 warned against. Humanity was lured into compliance through the fantasy world brought about by the mass media by means of advertising, cinema, and television. Another enticement was the growing availability of mass-produced consumer goods. And so what's happened is we're losing industrial production. We are turning into a police state. 9/11 is what triggered and initiated the introduction of the police state. We have been lured into this fantasy world through the newspapers and mass media, which is controlled by the ruling elite, and advertising and movies and TV, which are presenting a world that isn't real, and then the enticement of acquiring things, mass-produced consumer goods, is also grinding to a halt. As we can see, just wait another year or 2 years with the shutdown of international shipping. So now China is stuck with all this production, all these production facilities, and nowhere to sell their goods. And this is not just affecting the U.S., it's affecting the whole world, because oil prices have been in dollars, and 80% of commerce around the world is conducted in dollars. So as the dollar value drops, it really dents the economies of the global economy. It affects all countries. So it's unprecedented. This is on a scale that's never happened before.
Right. So just kind of going on from there, why would you call what is occurring now, a false flag operation, in the same way that 9/11, September, the attack, quote attack, was actually a false flag operation. That is, it was an inside job in order to, with certain, conducted by covert elements of the U.S. administration, the Bush administration, and the military intelligence complex.
Well,
for certain reasons.
Let's just go back to the definition of a false flag operation. By definition, it is covert operations conducted by governments, corporations, or other organizations which are designed to deceive the public in such a way that the operations appear as though they are being carried out by other entities. The name is derived from the military concept of flying false colors, that is, flying the flag of a country other than one's own. False flag operations are not limited to war and counterinsurgency operations, and they have been used in peacetime. Well, for example, 9/11, for example, the Mumbai bombing, for example, the bombings in London, these are all false flag operations carried out for different purposes. But the purpose of 9/11 was because the internationalists were impatient with the rate of change that was occurring in their plans to implement a new world order or a one world government. And so the 9/11 false flag event was carried out to accelerate the rate of change. And it certainly did. It also drove the dollar up, the value of the dollar.
Right. So we've begun to define the Bush administration, which set up the conditions for the false flag event, as a kleptocracy. What do you see as that term?
A kleptocracy is... Well, I'll give you the definition of that. The root of klepto plus kratein, that's the root of kleptocracy, it just means rule by thieves. And it's a term applied to a government that extends the personal wealth and political power of government officials and the ruling class, which we would collectively call kleptocrats, at the expense of the population. And so what they're doing is stripping the wealth of the citizens and the country and the citizenry to concentrate wealth upwards and consolidate their control and power over the citizens of a country, or in this case, it's global. It's the whole global community that's being stripped, not just the United States, but the international financiers who are behind it. The City of London, Rothschild interests, have always had a big grudge against Russia and against the United States because they were very, very strong Christian countries, and the U.S. and Russia have been very deep friends for many centuries. People don't really realize that. Russia and the United States are really pretend enemies, and they are actually secret collaborators, for instance, during the Cold War on exotic weapons development, the HAARP system. And so the Soviet Union Russia was targeted with the Bolshevik Revolution, which was funded by Wall Street financiers. Jacob Schiff, who was CEO of Kuhnloeb and whose family had intermarried with the Rothschilds in Frankfurt in the 1700s. They shared a house together, and so their children intermarried. And so the Schiff family actually represents the Rothschild interest. They're the same entity. And so these international financiers, in order to grab the wealth and steal it and to concentrate it upwards, they have to carry out these different kinds of operations, intelligence operations, false flag operations, in order to bully and frighten and intimidate and psychologically manipulate populations that they want to steal things from.
Right. Now, I'm beginning to look at the chart of who owns the Federal Reserve. Why is that important, who owns the Federal Reserve system?
Well, the reason that Russia and the United States have been targeted by the international financiers is because Christianity prohibited usury and money lending and banking from the time that, of Christ. And it wasn't until the 1700s that the Pope would not allow money changing or usury, and the people, Muslim people or people of Islam, are not allowed to practice banking or usury today. So in the 1700s, for some reason, the Pope reversed the Catholic position, the Catholic Church position, and allowed banking. And so very, very strong Christian countries, Russia and the United States in the 1700s and 1800s, even though Christianity allowed banking, they did not want the international financiers from the City of London, the Rothschild interests, setting up central banks in their countries. And the Federal Reserve has nothing to do with the U.S. federal government. It's a private central bank, and it serves the interests of the international financiers in the City of London, and it's privately owned. And that chart that you have of who owns the Federal Reserve Bank is very, very interesting. Why don't you bring up some of the names on it?
Yeah, well, I'll just read from this. For those who are listening, you can Google, just Google International Citizens 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal, and you'll go there, and you'll see right at the top there's a whole web page for this co-op radio program called The Economic Takedown of the USA Part 1. And in there, there'll be a link. There's a whole number of links, and there's one to who owns the Federal Reserve. And it's a chart that is essentially has not changed much over the past number of decades, and I'll just read from it. It says, Chart 1 reveals the linear connection between the Rothschilds and the Bank of England and their London banking houses, which ultimately control the Federal Reserve banks through their stock holdings of bank stock and their subsidiary firms in New York. The two principal Rothschild representatives in New York, J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb & Company, were the firms which set up the Jekyll Island Conference at which the Federal Reserve Act was drafted, who directed the subsequent successful campaign to have the plan enacted into law by Congress, and who purchased the controlling amounts of stock in the Federal Reserve Bank. And so if you go through this chart, which I urge you to do, it's quite extensive, and it names people, and it names principles quite extensively. And you go to the top of the chart, it traces ultimate ownership to N.M. Rothschild, London, Bank of England. who owns the controlling interest in all of the banks that own the Federal Reserve. So it's a virtual octopus leading back to the Rothschilds. And I should say that there's documented evidence that the net worth of the Rothschild holdings is $100 trillion.
At least.
And just to name some names, from Rothschild it goes down to the J. Henry Shorter Banking Corporation. I happened to work for them in 1962. In the summer of 62, I got a job there as a messenger on Wall Street for the summer. I was a sophomore in college, and paid me $50 a week. At the other side, there's Brown Shipley and Company, and that goes all the way down to Brown Brothers Harriman, which you've heard of. That was the company which financed Adolf Hitler, among others. And
another Rothschild interest.
Yes, it financed the Bolsheviks. So here we're dealing with the instrumentality that was used, i.e. the Federal Reserve, that was used to carry out, which is a private bank. There's, I think it was Dennis Kucinich who just said, the Federal Reserve Bank is as federal as Federal Express. FedEx,
yeah, right.
Private company.
Right.
So the Federal Reserve Bank was used and is still being used to carry out the economic false flag operation against the United States of America with the purpose of taking it down. And I wondered if you could begin to elaborate on the mechanisms of how that's being done from your knowledge.
Well, basically, the bankers use weapons of mass destruction and other exotic technologies to engineer banking crises through false flag operations. And when I got let's just talk about the mechanisms for how they do it. They create depressions and banking disasters. They just pull all the strings and they happen, which result in famines. There was a huge famine in Russia engineered by the Bolsheviks and Stalin in between 1932 and 1933, and 5 million, mostly Ukrainians, starved to death. It was just incredible. How could 5 million Ukrainians starve to death when it was the breadbasket of Russia? And that results in depopulation. The same exact thing happened in the United States between 1932 and 33. Now, Stalin wanted to take back the land that he had sort of bribed peasants with to join in the Bolshevik Revolution. He gave them land to farm, and then in the 1930s, he wanted to set up communes, and he wanted that land back. They didn't want to give it back. They wanted to pass it on to their children. So he just simply starved them to death. And in the United States, the farmers were the target of the Depression, the famine between 1932 and 33. And they were well-to-do farmers. The banks foreclosed on them. They were thrown out into the streets with their families. 7 million farmers. And a million families, their families, were out in the streets starving to death, and over 6 million people starved to death in the U.S. between 1932 and 33. And what the U.S. government did was they slaughtered 6.5 million pigs and burned the meat so that no one could get it who was starving, and any food that was not paid for in stores was picked up and thrown overboard or buried or burned so that starving people could not eat that. And so both the Russian and the U.S. famine were carried out exactly the same way for exactly the same reason, for a land grab. And Harold Ikes, who was in the cabinet of President Roosevelt, was the person who engineered the 1932-33 famine, and he was also responsible for another land grab in World War II, which was to take the farmland away from Japanese Americans by putting them in concentration camps. So these are deliberately engineered. People are deliberately starved to death. They create environmental disasters, and then there are methods they use to eliminate competitors. They are now exploring for mineral deposits from satellites. Bechtel has mapped a lot of mineral deposits around the world using radio tomography from satellites. And so they displace people, or they starve them out, or they use biological weapons, ethnic-specific bioweapons, where they can target tribes or ethnic groups or whatever to get rid of them. And that's exactly what we've been practicing in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yugoslavia, was to contaminate their countries completely with radiation and destroy future generations. We're doing the same thing in the Congo, in the Sudan, and Somalia. And these are all for land grabs and resource grabs. Now, very recently, I took a graph of monthly crude oil prices. And this is from 1946 to 2009. And don't ask me why I did it. Could I just
jump in to say that this chart is also online. If you go to the just Google International 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal, and it'll bring you right up to that website. And at the top, in the Co-op Radio, the Economic Takedown of the USA Part 1, in the article appears this chart of oil prices linked to the decline of the dollar, 1946 to 2009. Okay, Loren, could you tell us more about this?
Yes. So what I did was I plotted the false flag operations and phony wars that have occurred since the 1973 oil crisis, which Kissinger was involved with. And that is very interesting, because between 1946 and 1973, oil prices were very low and very stable, and there was hardly any increase at all. Basically, it's a flat line. But in 1973, the oil crisis occurred, and the Yom Kippur War in Israel in the Golan Heights against Arab tanks was sort of the first time that oil prices jumped after that excursion. And it was also the introduction of depleted uranium weapons to the battlefield, because the U.S. gave Israel depleted uranium weaponry and supervised them using it in the Yom Kippur War, and they just wiped out the Egyptian and Arab tanks like in 5 days. But they also completely contaminated the Golan Heights in Israel with a pernicious, permanent poison. And uranium is especially devastating for women because it causes infertility and reproductive cancers of the ovaries, the uterus, and reproductive cancers anyway, breast cancer. So that was the beginning of the uranium wars. It was 1973, the Yom Kippur War. Now, oil prices, when the dollar declines, that's when they engineer the wars to drive the dollar up, and also oil prices go up as the dollar goes up. So the next big hike in oil prices, which strengthened the dollar, was the 1979-1980 is when the Iran-Iraq War started, which we funded both sides and armed both sides, and we didn't care whether Iran or Iraq won that war, but that really drove oil prices up. And then they started falling again to 1986. They were very low, almost down to the pre-1973 prices, and Chernobyl happened. Now, Chernobyl was engineered. It was a false flag operation carried out by, for sure, the CIA, probably the Mossad was involved, and MI6, British intelligence.
You mean that these agencies actually sabotaged the Chernobyl nuclear plant?
Yes, they did. Or they had Russians inside the plant who were instructed on how to do it. And an Indian admiral told me he had inspected nuclear power plants all over Russia. He said, it's impossible for Chernobyl to have been an accident, because 12 levels of safety measures to prevent an accident like that had to be dismantled in order, in a certain sequence in order for Chernobyl to happen. He said, quite frankly, Chernobyl was carried out to end the Cold War. And it certainly did turn Russia into a sick old man. The radiation illness even today is horrible all over Russia from Chernobyl. So that drove oil prices up for a while. And then Gulf War One in 1990, at the end of 1990, really drove oil prices up again, higher than the Yom Kippur War. But then they started falling again, and the Yugoslavian War of 1995 sort of eased the prices up again. And when they started to fall by 1998, they were low again. The NATO attack on Yugoslavia significantly drove oil prices up. And then they started falling again. So in 2001, we had 9/11. And since 9/11, oil prices have just gone to historic highs, that it's the highest oil prices in history.
Now
they started falling again in about 2006. So the Israeli attack on Lebanon was carried out in the summer of 2006, and that drove oil prices up to a real peak. Now they started falling again in 2008 precipitously, and so we've got the Gaza attack.
Right. So if this chart follows, then you would predict that the forces behind the petroleum industry, the owners of oil, would seek to drive up the price of oil if we're still on the oil war cycle by engaging in another major war. Is that?
Well, yeah, let me just quote Richard Berta, who was a Western Regional Inspector for the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Energy when I became a whistleblower and went to him with complaints about fraud and contractor fraud at Livermore in November of 1991. And he said to me, look, the nuclear weapons labs exist for the Pentagon, and the Pentagon exists for the oil companies. So how much more succinct can you be than that, Alfred? And this history of oil prices, 1946 to 2009 on this chart, is linked to the decline of the dollar. And Matthias Chang, the former secretary and economic advisor to Tun Dr. Mahathir, the former prime minister of Malaysia, who invited you and I to Malaysia 2 years ago, Matthias was kind enough to explain what this chart really meant. He said, whenever the dollar value declines, there is less demand for the dollar and puts the dollar at risk as the global reserve currency. The price of oil is hiked up with a war or a false flag to create a demand for dollars, as all oil trade and over 80% of world trade is denominated in dollars. Whenever the Federal Reserve, the private bank you just explained, prints money and floods the market with paper, which devalues the dollar, watch out for a price hike in oil. And when the excess oil is mopped up by the Arab OPEC consortium, the oil price goes down. Parallel to this is also the need to have armed conflict, as this is in tandem with hiking the oil price, which will also ensure a demand for oil. And that's exactly what this chart shows. Dollars equal war plus oil.
So, well, now there, I've seen parallel theories advance or speculation that the precipitous price of drop in the price of oil now is really to attempt to bankrupt the OPEC economies.
Well, that's certainly true. And by driving the oil prices down, when the oil prices go down, then the U.S. government and the international financiers want to drive them back up again, because they make the money. And the poor global population is paying more and more and more for energy consumption. And that is how they concentrate wealth upwards. It's by maximizing profits. It's a way to steal money from the populations around the world. And since they control the money game, they can do anything they want to. Kissinger said, just a moment,
yeah.
As Kissinger said, if you control the food, you control a nation. If you control the energy, you control a region. But if you control the money, the banking, the financing, you control the whole world.
Right. And so when you're saying they control, we can really identify that they now, which goes back to the chart of the ownership of the Federal Reserve, that identifies the they as the stakeholders behind the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization and the stakeholders behind the permanent war economy who keep this going, who have targeted the U.S. for economic takedown.
And two of the best articles to explain the complexity of, for instance, 9/11 as economic terrorism and this mortgage crisis and everything that's related to it, it's another economic false flag operation and intentional takedown and collapse of the U.S. This is all state-sponsored terrorism. And Richard Cook wrote this article, which is posted on your website, Extraordinary Times, Intentional Collapse and Takedown of the USA, which explains really very clearly the relationship between the U.S. and Russia and how banking and bankers use wars and debt and financing to create a slavery society. And then General Ivashov, who was in charge of, he was chief of staff of the entire Russian military when 9/11 happened. He wrote a very, very succinct and very good article, about 2.5 pages long, International Terrorism Does Not Exist, and that's on your site also. And so what he explained is the dynamic of false flag operations, and he said they cannot exist without intelligence agencies funding and controlling them and protecting them. He said the U.S. is the most protected country in the world, and the Pentagon is probably the most protected building in the world. And so he said 9/11 could only have been carried out by intelligence agencies and maybe some politicians or the oligarchy in the U.S. And so it was really carried out by the CIA, the Mossad, the U.S. military, and MI6. It was an international economic terrorist event.
Well, given, if we take the example, using that parallel of the Soviet Union and the United States in 1932 and 1933, where in the Soviet Union, I think the total number of deaths in the Soviet Union caused by the internal Bolsheviks or the state party apparatus kind of on internal genocide was approximately 66 million. Is that a correct figure?
Oh, in 1932-33.
Well, no, throughout
the Bolsheviks murdered almost 70 million ethnic Christian Russians. And in World War II, General Dwight David Eisenhower was sent to Germany. He was at the bottom of the list of generals. He was a West Point graduate. My grandfather was at West Point with him. And he was a very mediocre officer, Eisenhower was. But he became friends with Bernard Baruch, who was extremely influential under a number of presidents and certainly in World War II. And he was a Wall Street banker. And Bernard Baruch actually facilitated Dwight Eisenhower's rise through the ranks and to commanding posts and finally into the presidency. And so it was Bernard Baruch who influenced the transfer of Eisenhower to Germany right after the Germans surrendered. And it was Dwight Eisenhower who set up death camps and was responsible for starving to death deliberately 5 million ethnic Christian Germans.
Now, why do you think Eisenhower did that?
He hated Germans.
But, I mean, is there a connection to the greater subject that we're talking about, i.e. the international banking realms, or is that
it is directly connected to them, and all of the problems in Germany started before World War I when they refused to have central banks. They did not want central banks in Germany because Germany's a very Christian country also. And so all of these countries and the horrible bashing they've experienced, Germany and the Russia and now the U.S. is going through the same thing. They're going to destroy the United States. It's all related to bankers' interests.
Okay, now this gets to your point because you just said, quote, they're going to destroy the United States. Now, if we look at what Cook says, he says, well, we could have a transformation of the monetary system with a guaranteed national income, a bank that would put money directly into circulation. You eliminate fractional reserve systems, and you have a bankruptcy reorganization of the entire $50 trillion of existing debt in the U.S. Okay, so there's a way to solve it. But what you're saying is that they're, quote, they, namely the international banking interests that we've identified now on the chart, their actual names, they could be served and prosecuted in a court of law. They're going to destroy the United States. Could you state how and why and when, you think?
Well, they're driving people out of their homes by foreclosing on mortgages. All these wars that they've engineered have resulted in the U.S. and NATO becoming the military proxies for Wall Street and the City of London financiers. And these uranium wars, which started in 1991 by the U.S., have medically disabled over 1 million soldiers and National Guardsmen from our states. Now, why are they sending National Guardsmen to wars overseas when the National Guard is meant to serve the needs for natural disasters and other purposes in our states? What they're doing is killing our National Guardsmen and our military, and this will allow and enable and minimize the resistance to foreign troops, UN troops, they're already here in the U.S., coming in and taking over. Now, in World War II, when the Japanese Americans were rounded up, listen to this. The first stage of the operation took only 72 hours between 1941 and 42. They rounded up the ethnic Japanese Americans and stuffed them in concentration camps. Well, those concentration camps had been constructed some time before and were sitting there waiting to be filled up. KBR and Halliburton, KBR is a subsidiary of Halliburton, and other contractors have built over 800 concentration camps in the United States, throughout the U.S., and there's a very, very large facility that will hold 1 million people in Alaska. And that's supposed to be the mental gulag, which is similar to what Stalin created in Siberia in World War II. And so we just see the same things being repeated over and over again. It's like it's all on the front page. There's nothing secret about it. Why would they build 800 concentration camps if they're not going to fill them up and use them? Of course they're going to. And those concentration camps were started illegally, just like the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Military Agency, was illegally started by Colonel Oliver North. The Iran-Contra money and arms and drug sales and everything, that money went to begin construction of these concentration camps in the U.S., and it's never stopped. They've continued constructing them since Oliver North.
Well, FEMA is now called the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Well, they just put a candy coating
now,
on
now, it. Now, just to continue on that, I'm reading here from an article that says numerous states introduce legislation which set out the conditions from seceding from the United States. And that is that, for example, the legislatures of New Hampshire and Washington State have introduced bills declaring they will not submit the United States government if the federal government acts unconstitutionally. And this is pursuant to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, that all powers not expressly delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states. And they're identical to the bills in California, Oklahoma, and other states. Now, do you think this is part of a movement of balkanization of the United States?
I think so, and what I see is I see the 10 regions emerging from this that Reagan declared under executive order. He divided the United States into 10 regions, and what they want to do is to destroy democratic government. So they want to get rid of city, county, state governments. and replace it with administrative bodies that administer what's going on, but there's no participation by the citizens. This is basically what they've done in Europe with the EU. And they're also doing something called fusion, which is pulling in the firefighters and the police into a federal structure, and the cities and the states are mandated to continue paying for them, but they have no jurisdiction over them.
Well, for example now, a number of the states are beginning to pay in script, that is in IOUs,
yes,
such that civil servants, firemen, police, welfare recipients, etc., will begin to receive IOUs. Is this the part of the collapse of the state of the state system of the United States?
It's bankrupting all the states. The states are something like 46 states are on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yeah. So, and this is the result of intentional economic warfare.
This is a false flag economic operation.
This is a false flag economic operation. So, why doesn't the Commander-in-Chief, Barack Obama, identify it as such?
Well, because he's part of it. The whole point of having a two-party system in the United States is because it's much more stable than a single-party system. With a single-party system, it's very easy to overthrow or toss out whoever the ruler or dictator or whatever you want to call him is. With a two-party system where you have Democrats and Republicans running against each other, they're actually the same party, but it's just a smoke and mirrors dog and pony show to trick the public into thinking they're actually voting and they really have a choice. And so each time, whatever party they're angry at, they can vote them out, vote the rascals out, and bring this other party in. But what they're doing is they're getting the same dinner from both parties, no matter who they vote for. And the whole point of all of it, this charade, is to make sure that the elitists have no change in their agenda, whatever is being rolled out.
So the outcome, What would you predict would be the outcome of 8 years of an Obama presidency?
Well, a lot more people are going to lose their jobs. A lot more people are going to be homeless. There are tent cities. I've seen them outside of Reno, Nevada. They're turning parking lots into, they call them hostels in Los Angeles for people living in their cars. I see homeless people everywhere.
Right, and in terms of the constitutional structure of the states, I mean, the U.S. Constitution is structurally composed of 50 states, which are sovereign entities. But if those entities are bankrupt, then how does the United States itself evolve? What happens to it?
Well, then the states are bankrupt, and so then it's much easier for the federal government to impose law and order and this 10-region country that they want to create with administrative leadership rather than elections. This is what they did in Europe. It's basically what the EU is. And so you just see people getting poorer and poorer.
Exactly. So that then, one, there's an erosion of constitutional rights, an erosion of electoral rights, an erosion of state rights.
There won't be any rights.
Uh-huh. And how do you think that, we're just in the last few minutes here, but how do you think that such a devolving United States will relate to Canada in terms of the North American Union, et cetera?
Well, what they want to do is to impoverish Mexico, the U.S., and Canada, and by doing that and starving people, it's much easier to take over. And people who are starving are much more willing to go along with an agenda that is going to give them shelter and food, and so that's what they're going to do. It's to create hunger and famine and fear, and to make people submit to whatever the agenda is.
Right.
Now, and religion is also used for that. Religion is used to as a mechanism to create submission of countries, people in countries.
Right. Well, we're beginning to we have just a few minutes left in this part. We'd like to continue in a second part and come up with some of the thinking of authors like Joseph Stiglitz, who are recommending that the banks just fail.
Well, they should just declare bankruptcy. They should walk away from all that debt globally, and then what can the international financiers do? If
right.
everybody walks off their chessboard, what can they do? We need to decentralize food. We need to decentralize water and power. And every city, the citizens in every city should own their own water company and their own energy company. And the food consumption, it should be produced locally.
Good. Well, we'll end the conversation here on that note, and perhaps in part two, come back with looking at the long history of state-engineered famine and land grabs and really go in depth into the Russian famine and that history, which we know was engineered by the international bankers, and see how they're in depth engineering it in North America. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Alfred. Thank you very much.
We've been with Lorraine Murray, who's an expert witness at the Tokyo International Tribunal for War Crimes in Afghanistan. She's an independent scientist, and we've just been listening to part one of the economic takedown of the USA. For more information and to listen to a audio archive of these programs, please Google International War Crimes 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal, and you'll come to a summary of this program. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.coopradio.org. This is the Monday Brownbagger. I'm Alfred Weber. May you have a wonderful and miracle-filled day. Thank you.